Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%. Based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello, and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, an AAA battery, and I love films. As Bill Gates once said, people everywhere love Windows. And Terminator 2 Judgment Day, they're both flawless. I don't know that they're comparable, but fair enough, Bill. Every week I invite a special guest over, I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Nish Kumar, Ricky Gervais, Catherine Ryan, and even Hed Lambles. But this week, my special guest is the brilliant comedian, actor, writer, and podcaster, Mr. Richard Herring. Get over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you will get the entire episode completely uncut as a video. You also get an extra 20 minutes of chat and questions with Richard, where we discuss the best openings and closings to films. Plus, each guest who does the show tells the Patreons a secret. This week's secret is a smasher, of course, so check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. So how is everyone? Hope you're all right. Hope everyone is well. It's weird, isn't it, all this? Lots of love to you. So here we go. Richard Herring. Richard Herring, for goodness sakes. If you don't know Richard Herring, you're lying. He is the king of podcasts. He's the king of stand-up. He's the king of stone clearing. He's the king of playing snooker against himself. He's the king. It's bloody Richard Herring. I was very grateful for him for giving me his time. We recorded this a couple of weeks ago over Zoom. It's a cracker. You're going to love it. Anyway, that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 96 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by an actor, a writer, a novelist, a headmaster's son, a child.
I'm a comedian.
And I'll get to that. An adult. I'm putting them in order of importance. Okay. A father, a husband, okay. One of the most successful, self-made people I've known, more than Richard Branson, and a sketch comedian, and most of all, one of the finest stand-ups of his generation. Please welcome to the show, the brilliant Mr. Richard Herring!
Hey, thank you. It's lovely to be on. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you. What an honour. Thank you for doing this. We're doing this in lockdown.
Yep.
Across a Zoom. You look very well.
Thank you. I'm not too bad. Last week I thought I'll start trying to diet and exercise and use it as a health farm, but I've stopped drinking last year and I've started drinking this year and I've been drinking quite a lot, so it hasn't quite worked out. But it's been largely, I'm lucky I live in the countryside and I'm with people and I like all of them.
Yeah.
And two of them are quite young and annoying, but it cheers you up to have two little kids around the place.
How old are the young ones?
They're five with? And two and a half. So if I could have it as exactly I wanted, I'd have them being maybe five and seven. The 2.5-year-old is a little bit much to cope with all the time. Without any outside help and any mother-in-laws coming around to take the pressure off and now any babysitters. But he's lovely and they're actually getting on very well together, even though, you know, he's quite annoying and she's a bit more sensible. So,
how is your experience of being a teacher now?
now you're homeschooling. Are you a good
teacher?
Well,
I mean, it's we haven't had to do too much yet because there was the Easter holidays right in the middle of it. So it's my daughter's only five, so it's first year of primary school. It's kind of fun, and they've sent us lots of apps and stuff to use. And we go on little nature trails. I'm out in the countryside, as I say. So sometimes they just give you a sheet and say, go and find a red flower and a yellow flower and take some photos of it and go and, you know, tick off all these things. Those have been really lovely. And actually getting a little bit of time. The first one I did with just my daughter and my wife looked after my son. And that was actually lovely. You realise how little time you get with them individually.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly in the middle of the day, you would never go out with my daughter would be at school, you know, so just to go for a walk with my daughter on her own. And it just, I think it's helping to bond the family a little bit. It's nice. So I understand it's hellish for lots of people and there's lots of bad things about it still. And we've all been well so far. So it's not been a hellish experience for us so far. It's not that different than my actual life. You know, I spend a lot of time here anyway.
Yeah. Does your daughter respect you as a teacher?
No.
Right.
No, she doesn't. She doesn't respect me as a father or a teacher. She's very much a teenager already. And she loves her mum and she just takes the piss out of me constantly. And like sometimes a bit cruelly, but usually I think she thinks she's being funny usually. So she knows that I like jokes, so she's trying to be funny, but sometimes it's pretty brutal.
Really? She heckles you as you move around the house.
It is, but it's like, you know, she tells me how fat I am. She tells me she wishes I was dead and all this sort of stuff. But she does, you know, I think she does know what it means exactly. But she always looks to me if she's trying to be funny. If I laugh, well, if she makes her mum laugh, she's pleased, more pleased because I laugh at everything. But she's always, you know, you can see her trying to be funny and then looking across at me to see if I'm laughing at it. So,
wow.
They're basically at my level of humour of fart jokes and poo jokes and.
So she says, I wish you were dead, and then gives you a cheeky look back. Yeah?
Sometimes, when she doesn't give me the little wink, then it's upsetting. But no, it's weirdly, I think this has brought us all a bit closer together, really. So she's being a little bit nicer to me overall. But yeah, you sort of assume being a father, your kids, and I don't know why you assume this, because it's not how you were as a kid. But your kids will be grateful and love you, and certainly when they're little, that it'll all just. But you know, they're just exactly the same as we were when we were kids and horrible little pricks, being selfish and testing the water to see what they could do. And my daughter just instantaneously recognised me as the weak member of the family that she could pick off. She's very high status, and she doesn't it's difficult to teach her because she goes, no, I know how you're trying to show her how to do one little thing on the computer. And she can't do it. She goes, I can do it. And she can't. So she's very headstrong. I don't know where she gets it from. I don't understand that.
I've just realised something, which is I remember being a kid, and I've now seen it with my nephew and niece, and I think it is just what kids do, which is you finish school and your mum and dad go, how was school? And you go, right, what happened? Nothing.
Yeah.
And they're always like, what happened? Nothing. Nothing. And all they want to know is what happened. And now I'm thinking with all this homeschooling, all the parents are going to be like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
It's
a good point.
It really was nothing. Well, I'm so glad to hear, because I've heard a lot of people want to murder their children and wife, so it sounds like you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, I think if anything, we're getting on better than usual, so that's kind of, you know, there's ups and downs in any marriage, but...
Fingers crossed it continues.
Yeah, let's stay. If my wife has no opportunity to escape from me, she goes, well, I might as well just make the best of it. But yes, we're getting... I mean, I think it shows we like each other, really, so it's good.
Are you missing stand-up? Are you missing going out and touring?
Not that much, because I wasn't doing that much. I was doing a lot of stand-up, and then, O'Frig 50 was the last show I did, and that finished about nearly coming on for 2 years ago, and I made a decision not to tour stand-up for a bit and not write stand-up for a bit. So I've only done about three or four little charity gigs in stand-up. Mm-hmm. I've obviously been doing the podcasts, the Rahelister podcast, and I was touring those. But I've missed out on quite a few. It's been annoying because I thought this is a really good year. There was a few big things coming up, a couple of telly things that I was really looking forward to, hopefully which will be rearranged. But like at the end of March particularly, just a couple of the Birmingham Podcast Festival where I'd sold over 1,000 tickets, a gig I was doing it for O2 at the O2, but not at the big O2, but still a very well paid gig. It was a corporate gig I was doing. And I was sort of looking at the, this is all right. This month is going to sort of see me through for most of the year. And then suddenly all that's ripped away. But luckily, you know, I've obviously the online presence I've sort of built up is a great thing. So I was planning to get into Twitch anyway, and that sort of really jump started getting to Twitch, which so I can do some of my crazy snooker and stone clearing stuff, as well as Rahulastubber's live streamed. And you know, we're still the podcast. We did so many last year. We actually started spunking them out and doing two a week because we had so many in the storeroom, you know. And thinking, if we don't do this out, we won't be putting out the ones we're doing now till October, which would have been good. But we did about 3 months of two a week, so we could have been going for another 3 months, I suppose. We'd done one a month, but you know, luckily the thing that was the best thing of the year, maybe my life, was that Michael Palin did. No offense, my wife accepts this. And my children will accept it. Michael Palin did the first one of the London run, which was the last one we did. So yeah. I got it in. I think if we'd had, you know, I'd got him in right at the beginning of the year, I think January the 6th, they said they'd do it. And I was so looking forward to it. And I think if that one had been cancelled, as all the rest were, it would have been destroyed me. But it was just so wonderful to do Michael Palin.
Were you nervous with him? Do you get nervous with bigger people or people you
some of the bigger like. People, but Palin's like literally my absolute comedy hero. So to the extent I think it wasn't as it's still a great podcast thing, it hasn't gone out yet, but I was so in awe that I couldn't really be the Richard Herring character that I like to be on that podcast. So I was very reverent, and I just wish it's such a difficult one because you've got someone with such a rich career and like five or six careers really, and they're all it's a game all the way, and you've got an hour to talk to them. You're thinking, how am I gonna get all of this stuff in? And so I didn't want to dick around with all the stupid questions, but when I did all the stupid questions backstage in the little interview I did, he was actually great, and I just wish he basically improvised. We'll talk about Life of Brian a lot, I think, on this podcast. But he improvised a new scene for Life of Brian, basically, because I asked him a question about King Herod. And they said, we never did that in Life of Brian. And then basically started improvising a scene as King Herod. And so I kind of wish I'd given him more opportunity in the interview to do that sort of stuff. Though he was still great. And I was a little bit cheeky, but I was surprised. I thought I might cry and I thought I might, you know, dry up. And it was all right. So I got through it without being overly emotional. And actually on stage it was fine. But I was very, you know, because it's the pressure of, you know, I think often when it's someone, when I had someone like Terry Hall, who I love, but I'm not a big muso, and he's one of my favourite musicians, but I'm aware that the Terry Hall's the Specials fans and are going to be watching it, and you kind of go, I don't really know enough about music to do this justice. So those ones are more nerve-wracking for me, but, you know, I did know so much about Palin, and, he was so lovely as well. You know, you sort of worry he'll be... turn out to be not a nice person. Not that I knew he would, that wouldn't happen because everyone said how lovely he was, but he was just so self-effacing and modest and, you know, and up for it. It was really lovely. So I was really lucky to get him.
That's so great.
Yeah. So that was awesome. So that was the best, you know, that was probably going to be the highlight of the year. So it just did happen. I think if that hadn't happened, I would be a lot more anti the coronavirus than I am. I think the coronavirus is okay. It gets a bad press.
You think you've been really pro it, and I think it's refreshing.
Even though it's cost me a lot of money.
Yeah, but it saved your marriage.
Yeah, but I'm it saved my marriage. I met Michael Palin and I'm happy. I'm so lucky to have this outlet and to, you know, to have got to a point where I'm reasonably comfortably off anyway. But I'm sort of very fearful about the future of live comedy if this goes on for very much longer. You know, I think it's the clubs as much as the comedians. At least the comedians can probably find some part-time work to get them through to the other side of it. But if their clubs aren't there when they come back, and the theatres aren't there, and the arts centres aren't back, you know, that's where it's going to be telling. And it's difficult to say to people, hey, think about the comedians. No one's thinking about the comedians and all this. But it's important, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's all any self-employed people, obviously. Anyone who's running a business or just working week to week. So I've sort of been trying to kind of encourage everyone to think about that a little bit, as well as all the heroes who are actually doing the proper work and saving our lives.
Yeah. Richard.
Yes.
Oh, shit. I've forgotten to tell you something. Oh, no. This is bad. This is really bad. I should have said it up top. Yeah. It's weird we've been talking about all this stuff, how happy you are with your family.
Yeah.
This is going to come as a real downer. fuck, it's, I should have texted it to you, giving you some time to think about it. I'll just say it. I'll say it, I guess. You've died.
Oh, God. I thought something was a bit weird. Yeah. I thought things were going too well. Okay, that's how you know.
I'm so sorry. How did you die?
I think I probably died being crushed under a pile of stones that I'd gathered around the field near my house. And it got them to such a stupendous height, I threw one in, and then this, the whole thing. It's kind of where I want to be buried, so I'm happy with that. I kind of want to be buried on... I gather stones from my field. Do you know about this about me, Brett? I have a stone clearing podcast.
Yes.
So I started walking my dog about 18 months ago around a field, and it was very stony. And I just started... There was one little cairn in the corner and a pile of stones that people had picked up. And I kind of thought, well, I can use this time productively, and started putting stones to the side to help. I don't know if it helps the farmer or not, but I just thought it was something to do with the time. And then I became quite obsessed with it, and then, like, seriously obsessed with it. And then I did a podcast about it where I treat it as a sort of a joke, but I was doing it for reals. And so now I do a podcast that's telling people how to clear stones off a field in my attempt to clear about a billion stones off a 35-acre field. And then build a wall that can be visible from space. So I'm imagining that wall got a bit higher than I expected it to, and it's not been structurally tested. I'm not a surveyor or an architect,
right.
So it could easily fall and kill someone. So it'd be ironic if it killed.
Did it happen live on Twitch? Your death?
I hope so. Yes. Yeah. Although the Twitch is very unreliable out there, so probably what happened is it happened and I didn't manage to catch it on Twitch. There was a great stone clear, which I wasn't recording, where I thought I was going to die before, where a massive hailstorm hit the field. I was out at night time, and I could see lightning approaching in a straight, you know, hitting the ground, yeah, a straight line, like half a mile away, then a bit closer, and I thought... I was right in the middle of the field. There was no way of escaping. Shit. I was being hit by hailstones and thinking, I'm just about to get hit by lightning and I'm not even recording it. So I can't even...
This is a waste.
And it was too... I couldn't get to my phone. So, yeah. I'm certain I would have been trying to record it. I hope that my death is podcasted. I would hope it would be, but I doubt it was.
I like that your instinct as lightning was coming towards you was to grab your phone to make sure it hit you. I'm over here.
A lot of things happen out there. You'd think it would be quite an uneventful. There's been a fire out there. The other day, the ploughing starts, and then I was getting buzzed by tractors. There was fire engines on this field when there was a fire. The whole crop, the whole burnt stubble, the stubble burnt up and started to set fire to the back of the fences there. And I was out there stone clearing. It wasn't my fault. I could have started some fires, but I didn't start that one. There is flint out there. So I'd quite like to be buried under that cairn anyway. So if it's buried me, that's okay. I thought, like, as a sort of pyramid.
It's a time saving and money saving if what kills you is how you are buried as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I want to stay there.
It's efficient. Do you worry about death? I've seen you wrote a whole show about it.
I did write a whole show about it. I sort of think about it constantly. And I still, even though I think about it constantly, every now and again, I sort of think, oh no, but I am actually really going to die. but most of the time, I'm sort of like, no, I'm not going to die. I think about it all the time, you know. And then this has brought home. I think, like, realizing that as a 52-year-old man who's a bit overweight, suddenly when they start saying it's over 50, you know, if you're over 50, you're overweight, you might get... So you suddenly go, oh, you know, that is, it is an ever-present possibility. And I think I wouldn't... I've had a nice life, and from that point of view, it wouldn't be, like, the worst thing in the world. I think just having young kids suddenly brings home again, you go, they'd be okay, but I'd like them to remember me, and I'd like them that, you know, I'd like to not have a replacement dad. It would be you, I bet, as well. It'd be fucking...
Yeah, no, of course it would.
You'd be in there. You'd leave about 4 months and straight in. You'd have to look after the kids.
Well, also, I'd be in there quicker than I'd planned, because I didn't realise we had to... But I thought we were going to spend time burying you, but you'd done that for us, so I'm straight over.
So I, for my kids, I would like to, you know, you want to sort of see how the story progresses, don't you? It's and I would love to, you know, it's fascinating seeing kids grow and their personalities grow. And there's a part of you goes, oh, I wish I could just see them at 21 right now and see what they're like and what they're, you know. And, but you also go, it passes so fast, and you're doing so much management and so much telling off and so much just trying to get to the end of the day so you can go to sleep. It's very easy to forget to sort of enjoy each little time period, and because they're this age, both these ages are incredible. They're really good fun, but there's a big part of me that go, I wish they were just both for a day. You could just see them at 18 and 16,
wow,
or 20 and
so
18.
Interesting. Can I ask you a question? I this is a side question. Quick one. Your children are 2.5 and 5. Do you think their personalities that they have, they were born with, or they've become this way through, you know, being around you and all that?
It's a very big question. It's a lot of Shakespeare's plays are about this, Brett. I don't know if I can give you the full answer, but I don't
read that shit. Go on. You tell me.
I think they are pretty much born how they are, right? My daughter was always feisty right from the start. She came out really crying, but it had been a kind of a bit of a difficult... I think she'd sort of been a bit hurt coming out. They had to use a suction thing to get her out. And for the first hour of her life, she was really crying. And I thought, oh, God, someone had told me that's how they are. However they are in the first hour, that's how they are. And she was crying for an hour. But she then actually hardly ever properly cried again, like in that way. So she's been very calm, and she's you know, I think you could see just very on, she was early on, she was just very forthright and self-assured. And you kind of, what you're hoping is you're not going to knock that out of them somehow, which is, because I think kids are a little bit more confident until the, you know, until those things happen. So my main worry is we do something to change and make her worse. I think she's very assured. My son is sweet, and you know they're very different personalities. And I think if you were bringing, I mean, not that she's not sweet, but he's very innocent and sweet and affectionate. And my daughter's a lot tougher of a cookie to crack in that regard. You know, she's a lot more. She'll take her time and judge things. So I think that they both had the same basic upbringing, I suppose. So it would be weird if they, you know, they would have to be the same, wouldn't they? And they're not the same.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the fucking answer. Yeah. It would be the same. Me and my sister are not the same. Same upbringing.
Although, you know, you've then...
Why
is
Shakespeare
then
writing 25 plays about it? It's simple.
But then you have to take into account the siblings. So it's with having the older siblings and the younger siblings are a very interesting thing, you know, and so he looks up to her so much. And so you are influenced then, the second one's influenced by the older one in different ways, and then either becomes like them or veers away from them, I suppose. So yeah, it's more complicated than we've made it out to be, but we've pretty much got there.
I think siblings are more influential than parents.
Yeah,
I think I'm the way I am in relation to my sister more than how my mum and dad raised me.
That might be true, and I think it is. It's really important. It's a big thing, and it's you know, I think my brother and sister are both 5 or 6 years older than me, so that's really difficult. I was close to my sister, and my brother was, you know, I was more annoying to my brother, who was, you know, was at 10 when I was 4 or whatever, you know, and it's 14 when I was at 8, and you know, he'd bully me a little bit, as brothers would do, because I would have deserved it.
No, Richard, you were 4.
But so I think that certainly does affect things.
And I deserved it. That's so sad. 4-year-old trudging off.
I'm not
bed.
Victim blaming the 4-year-old, Rich Herring.
Oh, I deserved it, I suppose. Good night, Dad. do you think there's an afterlife? You're from a religious background.
My parents are and were religious. I think they're kind of not as strongly faithful as they were. I don't think there is an afterlife, and I kind of hope there isn't an afterlife. That's sort of what that We're All Gonna Die show was partly about. The kind of idea of living forever, I think, is, you know, what makes life A, work, is that you have a limited amount of time, but B, the idea of being eternal and you know, and not having a body as well. The body is the best thing about being alive. I think the physical aspects of being alive are the best things. As spiritual as I am, I don't want to spend the rest of the time without, you know, all of the
floating about
with all the good stuff, and also just the idea of living for eternity. You would get everything that you wanted done, thought and done.
So you as a ghost are just floating around going, I can't even have a wank.
Yeah, exactly. It would be exactly that.
What's the fucking point?
And you're in heaven and you haven't, you know, but anything, eating, blinking, you wouldn't have, I mean, I don't know how it works, how you see without eyes. I don't know how you, so it doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't, and I wouldn't, you know, and I'd probably be going downstairs rather than upstairs anyway. So the idea of being burnt up for eternity is even worse. And I was watching that George Carlin routine about that, you know, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to burn forever in hell. But he loves you. He loves you. It's a very weird, you know, the punishment is much worse than anything that you could possibly have done in your life.
Yeah.
So I don't believe in that. And yeah, I do, you know, things can change and, you know, time might not be the same and blah, blah, blah. But I see no reason why we should carry on afterwards. And we did, weren't here before, unless, you know, we've had it all wiped from our minds. So what, that we didn't have a problem with not being here for the infinite amount of years there were before, let's say 13 billion if there was no time. Sure. So it doesn't make sense that we would be hanging around somewhere for
it does seem
13 billion years.
It does seem an inefficient system, the reincarnation thing, to wipe your memory every time you start again.
Yeah.
It does
unless
seem
you're hypnotized.
Like, because that'd be, yeah, what are you, if you're constantly having to learn and get better, it's like, oh, but by the way,
yeah,
I won't tell you what you learned.
And, you know, you progress from being an insect upwards. I think Stuart used to do a routine about, you know, how'd you be a bad, you know, how'd you be a good or a bad fly? You know, how does the fly get to the point where you're allowed to become a, you know, a mouse now because you've been a good fly?
You did charity,
you know, fly, but there's no moral system. So, you know, I think logically I'd be, and no, I don't know if I would be like to be proven wrong. It would be nice to know what happens. It would be nice to have an investment in the next generation or two that you could see how your kids and grandkids got on. But equally, it would be tedious. And then after a while, it just becomes too many people to cope with, doesn't it? If they all keep breeding. So it doesn't make any sense to me. So, but I'd like to stay alive. And I also think having a time limit to life means that if we lived forever, I think you would just not really bother doing anything. I think life would become tedious. But the idea, you know, that jeopardy that you could just get run over tomorrow or fall under a pile of stones or catch a terrible disease, you know, keeps you going, keeps interesting, and keeps you moving. So, you know, I think within We're All Going to Die, I think I talked about this, but it's the fear of losing someone that makes you, that attaches you to people. So as awful it is if someone does die that you love deeply, that's the payoff, isn't it? To the sorrow is the payoff to the pleasure and the happiness you get from someone. And if you couldn't lose them, I don't think you would be as attached to them in life. So the biggest fear is losing my kids is obviously much more of a fear than losing myself. You know, it's heartbreaking. You know, you waste so much of your life thinking about that, but it's all there to make you try and protect them and love them and stay close to them. But you know, again, it's about appreciating people while they're here and being alive. But yeah, I don't think there's anything coming. Sorry, Brett.
Well, Richard, I've actually got terrible news for you. This is worse than the previous news. There is an afterlife. The guy's fucking ever. And all that work you did, you were like, oh, I better get this done. You had so much time. You had loads of time. There's a heaven and everything.
Oh, well, that's good. I suppose it's good in a way.
Yeah, it's all right. And listen, they're giving you a body that you can masturbate in when you need.
That's good.
So you're fine.
All of my films are just porn films.
Okay. So in this heaven, they're obsessed with films, as they would be, and they want to know about your life through film. And the first thing they ask you, what is the first film you remember seeing, Richard Herring?
Well, is this like the first film? I think it's the answer the same anyway. But if you're talking about the first film in a cinema, I think the first, we didn't go to the cinema very much at all when I was a kid.
Right.
So I do remember a lot of the times of us going. I remember, maybe we'll talk about that later, but I remember starting to go a bit more when I was a teenager with my friends. And they'd been a lot more than I had, to the extent, you know, I think we went to see some like the second Indiana Jones films and I'd never even heard of Indiana Jones. And I went to see the second one and I couldn't understand why everyone was laughing at all the back references, you know. So we were really, I don't know why, we lived in the countryside and, you know, my parents weren't like, you know, they were sort of quite old-fashioned. But we did. But then they set up a film club at school, so it's kind of weird. So they were into film. The first film I remember seeing is a double bill of James Bond films, and I'm not 100% sure what they were. I would have been about 5 or 6, I think. I'm pretty sure one of them was Dr. No, and I'm guessing the other one was Goldfinger. I think it was like a double bill of not current James Bond films, which would have been, you know, in the early 70s, 74, something like that.
At the cinema you saw these?
Yeah, we went to the cinema and saw a double, so it was like 2 films in a row. So I remember it feeling like the first time I'd ever been to the cinema, because that's the deal I remember about it more than the films. I remember I have a vague memory of something happening on a plane. I don't know which James Bond film that is.
There's
a few of them, though. But
there was a gun.
My name's Bond, James Bond.
It's Dr. No.
Last night, it's probably because of this, but I had a dream I was watching a James Bond film that was sort of partly in, but it was horrifically violent. And James Bond was psychopathic. And he caught this villain who was trying to do something terrible. And he started cutting up his sinews in his body so he couldn't move. So I don't know if that's because I knew I was going to be talking to you about James Bond. But I had this absolutely terrifying dream about a made-up James Bond film that went on for ages.
And you were in it?
It was awful. I was sort of in it, but I was mainly watching it. And I think just occasionally I was in it. And then Al Murray had...
You were like an extra in it.
I wasn't James Bond because I was horrified by what James Bond was doing, but I think I was helping James Bond, or he was saving me or something. And there was a bad man. And there was a bit on the plane in that as well, actually. There was a plane and the villain did escape even though had his sinews. It's not as good as a proper James Bond, but Al Murray had recommended it and was very upset that I didn't like the film in the dream.
That you were also in, so that you hadn't heard of.
Yeah,
I was in this. I forgot.
But yeah, I don't remember much about the Dr. No and Goldfinger double bill, but I remember that feeling of being in a cinema and that excitement of seeing 2 films in a row, which used to happen a lot in the old days. There used to be a lot, and probably one of the other things we'll talk about later is double bills. And often it would be like a film you weren't interested in, so there'd be a B film and a main feature. Sometimes it'd be two films that were of equal standing. There'd sometimes be a little mini film in between. It makes it sound like I'm from the 1920s, but
there was a war thing. Yeah, watch some news.
But there used to be like a little newsreel. I can't remember that. But I remember the excitement of going to the cinema, and I remember it was kind of an unusual thing.
And was it all of you, all 5 of you? Was it your mum and dad?
Yeah, it would have been. It would have been the whole family, I think. If I was there, it must have been the whole family. But yeah, I don't remember much beyond it being unusual that we'd gone to the cinema. And I must have seen films like on TV. But again, in those days, TV films weren't the deal. You know, you were watching a lot of Lauren Hardy and, old stuff on TV. And then at Christmas, something would come along that was a big film and you might be excited about.
Wow.
But I don't think
I remember being like, oh, this is amazing. What is this place?
I remember knowing it was unusual. I don't think early on I was that into it. I became much more into film than anything else for a while, aside from probably TV comedy. But a lot of my film choices are comedy as well. So it was a place where you got a chance to see, again, some of the comedy that you wouldn't been allowed to see on TV possibly as well. But I think it was later that even more like into my 20s that I sort of got into going to the cinema on a regular basis. But we lived in Cheddar, and there's no cinema in Cheddar except when the King's Wessex had a film club a bit later on. And then there was, we'll talk about this after, there was Wells and Weston-super-Mare, both of them about an hour away on the bus, and that was the only way we could get anywhere. Unless a parent was prepared to drive us and pick us up, which we sometimes managed to wangle. Again, I'll probably talk about that later on, because I don't know how we went and saw lots of inappropriate films at the cinema. And somehow got picked up by our parents. But then videos came out, and then when we were about 14, 13, 14, videos came out, and that's when we started watching a lot of things we should not have been watching at home.
Which maybe brings me to the next question, which is, what is the film that scared you the most, Richard Herring?
I don't think we saw this on video. I remember watching this with my brother one night, and so I must have been maybe late-ish teens. I might have been 16, 17 or something like that. I must have been older because it came out after I was. But I remember watching with my brother at home, so maybe I was at university, and it was on TV, I think, or maybe he got the video. But anyway, it was the original The Vanishing, Spurlos.
Oh,
which still kind of haunts me.
What a film.
And, like, unusually, there's lots of... We saw lots of things like Driller Killer and Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff on when we were watching Video Nasties when they came out on video. And I don't remember all that much about them beyond, they were meant to be scary. I'm very squeamish. And I suppose the thing with The Vanishing is... It's not really one where people are getting stabbed and...
There's no blood or nothing, no.
And I remember just being haunted by it because it's that... I mean, it's that sort of fear of losing someone. Yeah, and so the film... And the central guy in the original... And there's a new version of it, a Hollywood version, which I haven't watched, but I understand they has a happy ending and...
Yeah, it's mad. It literally plays like... the film, and then almost literally like a sort of sketch where they go, oh, by the way, and then sort of, I think it's Sandra Bullock runs in and goes, hey, here you are, and sort of rescues everyone. You go, what the fuck happened here?
Because he's so good, the guy in it. I haven't seen it since. I was really freaked out by it. So someone, a guy's with his girlfriend, this is from memory from probably 1990 or something like that, and they go to a service station and she just goes missing in the service station, and then... The film is him trying to work out what's happened. And I can't remember how much I can't remember how he contacts the guy or how much of the life of the guy we see.
The guy contacts him. He goes on, he's on the news.
Yeah,
and stuff,
so he's on news, yeah. So we see he's got a little goatee Dutch beard. And
he's got one of them Dutch beards.
He's a really nondescript kind of guy, but the actor playing it is just chilling. And so, I don't know how much we can go into spoilers with this. I don't want to sort of spoil what happens, but he's so determined to find out.
We can talk about it. And you can, if you're listening and you haven't seen this film, then skip forward 2 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth watching, but I just found it haunting and terrifying. That idea of losing someone and not being able to find them, the idea of this very calm guy who's abducted this woman, as it turns out, and then trying to find out what's happened, and then the boyfriend agrees, basically doesn't need to go along to say, I'll do exactly what I did to her and then you'll know what I did.
Yeah, it's either you don't know or you might be in terrible trouble, but you'll get to know. It's like, how much do you really want to know?
So I guess the hope that there might be some, she might be alive, the hope that something's happened keeps him going, but also it's just... He must know that he's probably going to end up in a horrible, horrible situation. But the not knowing is more than he could cope with. So it ends with him, if you watch the original version, it ends with him striking like his lighter. He's in the dark and he
takes a drink. He says, drink this and I'll show you what happened to it. And he drinks it and he passes out and he goes to blackness. And then
he's striking his lighter and he realises he's in a coffin and he's buried underground. That the kind of psychological haunt, A, to die that way, B, to die that way, knowing that that's how the person you were searching for also died. I haven't gone back to look at this, but he's sort of just quite the serial killer guy is just quite a regular family man, isn't he? And the kids playing upstairs.
Yeah. It also ends with him laughing. The guy in the coffin laughs at the end.
Oh, yes, that's right, yeah.
He's like, fucking... But the guy... I think about that film a lot because the story... In the middle, it changes point of view to the killer. And the killer is... Well, he's a psychopath and he doesn't have empathy, but basically he's a family man. I don't know if you remember this, but basically he's walking along one day and someone falls in the river and he dives into the river and he rescues the guy. And everyone's like, you're a hero. And he says in his head, I've just done something that's made me a hero. I've done something that was incredibly kind. I wonder what it would like to be experienced the opposite of that.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that. But yeah, that's good. That's good.
He's just sort of experimenting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a proper psychological look into the mind. Oh, no, and I've always been a little bit fascinated by that, that sort of ghoulish looking at the lives of serial killers and reading books about that sort of stuff. For a while, I've stopped doing it because it becomes too upsetting when you start to genuinely think about what's going on. Yeah. But, I suppose it's that, but it's that thing of all those true crime podcasts and people being fascinated with what drives a killer. And so it properly looks into that. So, yeah, I think it's a shame if someone then comes and digs up the guy and rescues him. I mean, is it her? In the film, in the Hollywood one, is it the girl?
No, it's the girlfriend, his new girlfriend or the new...
Oh, his new girlfriend, fine.
And then she digs him up, and then Jeff Bridges is the bad guy, comes in like, hey, don't interfere with this, and they have a fight and they kill him. Okay. It's really silly.
It was one of those things where, I think it might come on again and I didn't want to watch it because it upset me so much. So it stuck with me for at least 30 years, isn't it?
Yeah, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you like being scared?
I don't massively enjoy it. It wouldn't be what I really go for sometimes, but I think, again, at that point in my life, I really didn't like it, and I think it would lead on to, sleepless nights and bad dreams and stuff, which now I don't think...
Now you just get when you know you're doing a podcast with me.
Yeah, but I think, scary films now, I just think, what's the point? And, it's not... Yeah. It doesn't... They don't have that effect on me anymore that they kind of... Or I haven't seen one for a long time that's made me, actually feel, oh, I'm a bit scared to walk around the house now.
Right, that's good. What is the film, Richard Herring, that made you cry the most?
Well, I'll give you two answers to this because the one that made me cry the most is not it was to do with my psychological state at the time rather than the film.
Okay.
And the film that made me cry the most was Love Actually. Not in, isn't this sweet? I literally started crying to the point that I thought I would never stop crying. I was a bit depressed. I can't remember the circumstances of why it was. I was alone. I think I was alone. I don't like the film Love Actually. I think at the time I might have liked it a bit more than I do now, but I find the film Love Actually actually quite offensive in a lot of ways. Lindy West has taken it down very brilliantly. I can't do a better job than that, but basically it's a lot of men chasing after women who don't really say anything, and and the women who, literally, either they can't speak the language or they can't speak. And the women who can speak are all, have a terrible time. I don't really understand why the woman who fancies the younger guy at the office, played by that American actress called Laura Linney. I don't understand why the guy that he's about to fuck her, the young guy's in bed with her, and then she gets a phone call from the brother and she goes, I'm going to have to take this. If that was me, any monologue, they go, that's fine. I'll just wait here till you finish the conversation, and then I'll fuck you. It's not, I'll go, I better go. So there's no, it's going to be 3 hours. That's fine. We're back here. So that one doesn't make sense. So there's no reason why she shouldn't get the bit of dick she wants. But I can't remember what point it was in the film, but I don't think it was a particularly sad point, but I just, something in it, I don't know whether it's me, I think, I'm sitting on my own watching Love Actually, this is terrible, but I don't think I've cried ever like it in my life. I cried this kind of, just so depressive, I just remember the fear of not being able to, that I wasn't going to stop, that I was so depressed about whatever was going on in my life, and I can't even, and people who are depressed, I can't even remember what it was. Yeah, so I can't remember who it was or what it was that made me feel this way. And that's a very important lesson in dealing with depression. I'd moved, it was definitely after I'd been in Shepherd's Bush, so I'd moved into a house where I was meant to be living with my girlfriend at the time, who had a child from a previous relationship. So I bought kind of family house, and then we'd broken up. So I think it was around that time I'd moved into this house. And then it was, and I was in a family house on my own. And I think, and this relationship had got fallen apart. And I think that just, it sort of hit me. I thought, oh, I'm whatever. But I'd have been about 45 or something. I'm probably not, I wouldn't have been that old. I'd been about 30, 35, 36. Thinking, where's my life going? And that's the film at which I cried the most. But I don't think the film made me cry. And now, lots of films make me cry a bit. And I'm watching lots of kids' films. And I think the one that's made me cry the most recently is Coco. Have you seen Coco?
Maron. What a film.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah.
And the bit that really makes me cry, and I didn't even watch the whole film. We see it a lot because the kids watch films a few times. But the bit at the end where it does go back to what we were talking about before, but I'm obsessed with that kind of leapfrogging of generations and the way that, in that film, that grandmother's the child of the musician who's been wronged and the family's fallen apart, but she still remembers her dad. And my grandma, it's so reminiscent of my grandma. My grandma, when she was 102, and she died when she was 102, but she had dementia for the last part of her life. I've done again shows about her, and I think there might have been We're All Gonna Die as well, or maybe it's What Is Love anyway. But the last time I saw her, we went to see her, and it was just when I got engaged to Katie, and I think she died even before we got married. Not that she would have come to the wedding because she was too unwell, but We showed her the ring and everything, and she was going, "Oh, that's nice, that's nice." And the only my mum was asking what she remembered. She couldn't remember anything. We'd had this. I think the previous time we'd had this thing where my mum had been singing Claire de Luna, which was her favourite song, and trying to connect with her that way. And my grandma didn't know who any of us were, you know, and it was heartbreaking. But this slight last time I saw her, she was slightly more like happy, but she didn't know who any of us were. And the only person she remembered was her dad, Ernie. And that's it's not the only reason we called out my son Ernie, but it's just I found that just wonderful for the love of a daughter to a father that a 102-year-old woman would remember this guy who died before I was born, I think, but certainly 50 or 60 years ago. And that's the last thing, that's the last connection to the world in her mind, which is basically what happens in, and it's the same thing where it's a piece of music connects this old woman who's about to die back to her father who we've met in the afterlife, a Mexican afterlife. And she sings the song along with it. And I think maybe just because it resonates so much with what I went through in one of the sort of saddest moments in my grandmother's, my experience of my grandmother, of her failing to sing along with my mother to this song that she used to love. So I think, you know, it's beautiful anyway, but I think there's a real sort of personal connection within that. It's a great, it's a really strong film, and it's great that you can put a 5-year-old in front of that, and it's very heavy subject matter, but it's really delightful and celebratory.
Do you cry in front of your children?
Yeah. I mean, I don't cry a lot. I think probably films are the things that most that I do get to me. Sometimes they make me want to cry. I don't think I've cried in front of them at that. But yeah, I think it's good to be. You know, the difference is from my parents' generation to my generation. You know, there wasn't really. You know, my dad was not massively emotive. You know, they were great parents, but I think they felt they had to be these authority figures. And I think, and I feel glad that our generation is allowed to be. You know, you're allowed to try and be mates with your kids and hug them and tell them you love them. I mean, I tell my kids I love them much too much.
See, this guy's, I wish you were dead.
Yeah, exactly. But. But, you know, I think it's good to be emotional and show your emotions with your kids. So, yeah, I did. And there's a lot of those kids. The Inside Out was another one that makes the kind of realisation that sadness is important in Inside Out, and joy, realising that sadness needs to be there.
Good deal.
But as well as that whole thing of the girl, you know, again, which I think this will be a running theme, I think, through these, but that point, those points in your life where, in Inside Out, she's 12 or something, and you go, but it's that next step into that journey, and just remembering where you were at that point in your life as well, I think, is so a lot of watching these films really get to you.
That is lovely, Richard.
Thank you. And I can't be emotional in real life, but if I'm watching cartoons, I can cry.
Yeah, no, me too.
Or Love Actually.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%. Based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
What is the film that generally people don't like it? It is critically not acclaimed, but you love it and you don't care.
I'm not sure it's that critically unacclaimed. I've struggled a bit to think of this one. I mean, it's a film that I think a lot of people think is good, but it's a bit cheesy, and I don't think it's cheesy. I think it's genuinely one of the best films, and I love it. It's Total Recall. And I think it looks a bit dated. Mm-hmm. He's Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. It's a bit weird, but for me, it entirely works on an absolutely brilliant level. It's a fantastic film. It leaves you guessing. Even after it's over, you're still wondering what the truth of it is.
I'll hold my hands up and say, I do not understand Total Recall.
Do you not?
I don't understand it.
You don't understand it, or you don't like it? You don't,
I haven't watched it in years, but I remember watching it going, I don't have a fucking clue what's going on.
I think a lot of those sort of dreamlike, you know, I haven't really watched Inception, but I've seen so many parodies of Inception that I feel like I have seen it. But I think a lot of those things don't make sense. But it does make sense, and then you have to decide whether the whole thing's the dream. There's little clues to make it that it's his.
Do you think it is a dream?
So he's gone to a place to pay for it. Well, I think it's.
Or it was.
I think it might be his. That's his whole adventure. I think that's his whole adventure. Right. So I think it's all made up. And there's clues at the end, isn't the colours of the sky and stuff, and some of the pictures that flash by. But you're still not sure.
So at the end, does he go back to Sharon Stone as his wife? He hasn't killed her.
Yeah, I think he'll go back to Sharon Stone as well. That's what I think.
That's what I want.
And I think the whole, but either way, it doesn't matter. I just think it's a really good exploration of a sci-fi idea, and I'm very into sci-fi. And I think a lot of sci-fi is ultimately disappointing. A lot of things about this, about like alternate universes, and which we'll get onto, and time travel, annoy me because they don't get it right. I think this really gets the whole idea of what it is. Of if you could have your dreams implanted, how would it affect you? Would it be real? Would you start to question reality? And I think he's just good. I think there's some great jokes in it. I think Schwarzenegger's absolutely brilliant in it. I think the things that look a bit dated, the little man and the guy in the stomach thing is brilliant. I've seen it so many times, I should know all of what everyone is. There's a woman with three breasts in it. That's good. That's a good bit.
That's really good bit.
And the mechanical taxi driver is a great thing. I remember before I saw it, I heard someone talk about the taxi driver. So the first time I saw it, I knew that there was a twist with the taxi driver, which someone else will now know if they've not seen it before. But yeah, I think I tried to watch the remake and I didn't. It didn't have. There's a campness to it, I suppose, and there's pantomime element to it, but it's genuinely one of. I haven't seen it recently enough. I bought it about 3 or 4 years ago again on DVD because I was planning to do a podcast where I did director's commentaries of films that I made, you know, that I just liked or didn't like. And so I was going to do a director's commentary of Total Recall because I was really into it at the time, but I can't remember what things I love about it. Consider This a Divorce. That's a good joke. That's a good joke.
Good joke.
You know, there's lots of just nice, neat little twists in it, and I like Arnold Schwarzenegger talking to himself from the, you know, as the other guy saying, "Take this thing." It's nice. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger is really good, and I don't think he's very good in much. I think he's good in the Terminator, the original one, and I think he's quite bad in most things. But for some reason, it works. His level of acting works, and I believe it.
He's doing the right level.
And the eyes coming out at the end—that's brilliant. And just looking completely fake.
Yeah, love the eyes coming out.
I mean, I'd like the fact. I just think the special effects were presumably pretty impressive at the time. They're not impressive now, but also they've gone to some effort to make those. That's the thing. It's like, you know, it's not just CGI. They've worked hard to make it look that bad.
They've done plasticine boobs and plasticine eyes.
Yeah,
I love it.
So I do. I love the film. I do enjoy it.
That's good. What is on the other end of the scale?
Yeah,
a film that you used to love, but you've watched recently and you've gone, oh no, I don't like this anymore.
Well, this is, and I'm really surprised at this, and I didn't watch it all the way through, but I had to stop watching it. And this used to be a film I watched a lot and I loved. It's 12 Monkeys, and I had to stop watching it.
Really?
Yeah, and the reason I really had to say, I found it very slow to start with. I was watching, it was on catch up, and I thought, oh, that'll be great. Let's watch that. I love that. I haven't seen it for ages. I found it a bit slow to get going, and I found Brad Pitt unwatchably bad.
Really?
I found him, and I can't believe I ever watched it and didn't find him unwatchably bad, but it's such a mannered, fucking awful acting job of a crazy person.
Monkey.
Yeah, but I just absolutely had to turn off at that point, and I just didn't think, even without that, because he's not sort of central to the enjoyment of it, it's much more of a Bruce Willis film, but it wasn't as good as I remembered up to that point. And then the minute I'd watched four or five minutes of him, I thought, I absolutely cannot stand to watch the rest of this film. It hadn't fitted together in the way I remembered it. It wasn't as exciting as I remembered it being. It wasn't as kind of, maybe I ducked out at the wrong time. Maybe it gets better, but
shame.
I was disappointed in it. And that's the that is because it's a recent one, and that's the time it's happened recently. That's the only one I could think of that's really kind of gone, oh, because I had it on. I think I even got a. I had it on video. I had it. I bought the special edition video, probably with two. My memory is it's quite a big box. I think there was two videos in there, the 12 Monkeys.
Yeah, no,
or there
that,
was a pre-
that big
or a present of some
thing.
Kind. Yeah. So I think I was in. Monkeys. I was in, and I loved Terry Gilliam's. It is Terry Gilliam, isn't it? I would love his. I love like a lot of his stuff, and I still think I like Brazil. I didn't rewatch it when I interviewed Palin. I meant to rewatch it, but yeah, it just didn't quite hit in the same way. Even though it's almost. Maybe it's almost topical now, isn't it? I used to love Survivors, which is before your time, but it's about it's a TV show, and I watched it when I was much too young, and all I remember is the opening titles, which was about a man in China dropping a virus and then getting off a plane and then falling down dead and then everyone dying of a virus and a few people surviving. So that's come up a bit again recently, but it's, wow. 12 Monkeys had that element too, and it was this deliberate attempt to wipe out humanity, wasn't it?
Have you seen Le Jete, the original short? You would, I mean, you'd eat that up.
Okay.
Right up your street with your time travels and your multiples. You'd love it. And it's 22 minutes.
Oh, well, I'll look at it after this. I'll check it out after this.
What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because of the experience you had around seeing it that will always make it special to you.
Well, I think that I have to say this, but I think this was also the thing that did come to mind first. The first date to a cinema that I went with my wife, and it was sort of, well, I think I'll get to that. It was an important date anyway. We went to see Dan in Real Life, the Steve Carell. Yeah, and sort of did, and I think I remember umming and ahhing over what we're going to see, and I think we both liked The Office, the American Office, and we thought we'd give this a crack. It's not a good film. Very good film, and it's just, I can't remember. I honestly did not see very much of it though. but it was during this film my wife had been in a relationship with someone else, and there wasn't exactly overlap, but we'd started I'd been seeing her, but nothing had happened, and she'd moved to London away from her boyfriend, and we'd been sort of. We'd been on a few sort of dates, and it was very exciting, and something sort of, I knew something very important was happening. And it was during this film that she sort of leant over to me and said, oh, I've officially broken up with my boyfriend. You know, we've broken up with each other. And then shut up, Steve Carell's doing something meaningful. We sort of snogged all the way through the film, I think, basically. As and I was 40
Richard
years
Herring,
old.
I'm disgusted.
We were in the back row, so I don't remember much about the film. I remember that I wasn't disappointed to miss the film. I don't know if that says how much I wanted to kiss my wife, my now wife, or how much I didn't like the film. But I the film wasn't all that good. I got the sound. I think Stuart gave me the soundtrack to Dan in Real Life, as just he gives away stuff that he gets every Christmas. I don't think he knew it was significant, but I think I gave Katie the soundtrack to Dan in Real Life, but it wouldn't mean anything because I don't think either of us really enjoyed the film.
What
but
cinema
it was, that,
was it in?
It was in, the one on
Piccadilly.
No, it was in Piccadilly Circus. You know the big on the Omni, the big multiplex. You go up escalators to get to. I remember there was
the
a woman.
Trocadero, picture house.
Yeah, sort of behind the one in the Trocadero. I remember we were queuing and they weren't letting us go upstairs. And then we got into some altercation. I think we were canoodling a little bit. And the woman, started shouting. The woman in charge of the rope started shouting at us for getting in the way or something. Mm. And I thought that's a bit much. You know, there must be some courting couples coming to your cinema. You should be a bit nicer. It was in one of those screens upstairs, up the two escalators.
So your back row.
We got in the back row.
Other people next to you?
No, of course not. No, it wasn't a popular film. It wasn't a popular. We made the wrong choice in terms of films. But
so
if you're talking about an important thing happening in the cinema, it was. I knew it was coming. That we were that I you know the minute I not the minute I well actually the first time I met her I kind of felt something with her. We didn't see each other again for a few months, and then the second time I met her properly, I kind of was. Head over heels straight away. Just something overcame me that I couldn't really explain. And so then we a few months after that, we'd sort of met up a couple of times, but I kind of knew something was going on, and in my mind, I was thinking, this is the woman I'm going to marry and have kids with, and so it was, but unusually for me, it had been a very slow burning thing, and that I hadn't even considered the idea of trying to ask her to stay the night with me, and she didn't stay the night with me that night either, and so it was quite a slow and innocent build up to it. So it was a lovely moment to have that moment of this is going to be happening now.
Right, Richard, it's a beautiful answer.
Yeah,
I do have some questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
As a person who thinks the cinema is sacred. And would have been absolutely horrified. It's a beautiful answer, but my question is, so it's two questions. One is, she leans over mid-film, 10 minutes into it, how far into the film?
Can't have been that much long into the film, because we didn't see too much. But
she hasn't even got to the inciting incident, act one. She leans across.
Is there one? I don't know what happens in Dan in real life.
She goes, I'm breaking up with my boyfriend. You turn around, you start kissing.
Yeah.
Now, I guess my question is, if the film had been better...
Yeah. Oh, well, that is a good question.
If the film were, say, Enduring Love, which has a hell of an opening sequence, compelling, exciting, and she leans over and goes, I'm looking at my boyfriend, would you have gone, we'll talk about it afterwards, and you wouldn't be here now?
I think we'd still be here. I think she might not have leant over. If it had been a good film, she might not have leant over and told me. I think we were both quite bored by the film.
Right.
So it wasn't just we were both racing to, we're having a date and we thought this is a date. Let's go and see a film that we're going to enjoy. We've seen many more films. We've enjoyed many more films together. Some have been bad, some have been good. I think it was one of the worst films we've been to.
We've been to some
bad ones. So it's very hard to know. I think the moment would have come maybe after the film.
Which is the film you most relate to?
This is the recent film that I've most related to. I kind of struggled a bit to think of this, and it's a sort of slightly unusual... It's a bit of a left-field choice, but we saw Booksmart about 2 or 3 months ago.
Great film. It's
an amazing film. It's really funny. It's really good. I don't know why we'd left it so long to see that, but I was glad we did see it. I just think it's about... I mean, I think it's such a lot of film anyway, but it is about teenage girls...
Yeah,
but I was like them, the sort of smart, boring, virgin kid at school, and so I kind of really, and I don't think I ever even like at school probably did. I mean, I maybe wasn't quite as well behaved as they seem to have been, but I also don't think I had like a night where I went quite as nuts as they go in that film, or as quite as apt characters they go in that film. But I think it just really spoke to me about that. It was a very important point in my life, I think, that leaving school and that next step onwards, and also being sort of still basically a kid, because I'd worked much too hard at school to get to university and not really had much fun and not been able to let go. And it took me a long time. I still struggle with it. I think throughout my adult life, I've done better at messing around and letting myself go and behaving badly. But I was, and at university, I sort of stopped working and just got on with doing fun stuff. But I think that the poignancy of that time, that sort of leaving all those friends behind that you've made at school, I was really sad to leave school. I know a lot of people are like really happy to leave school. I remember my last day of school and thinking, oh, God, this everything changes. And, I'm going to really miss this. And I kind of, in a part of me, wants to stay. And a part of me still misses the regimented nature of school. For a long time when I was struggling to write on my own, I thought it'd be nice if just all the comedians got together in a...
Yeah, it would be nice.
In a school, and we had lessons. Just we all sat in a room and wrote together, and then there was playtime, and then we all had lunch together, and then there were some after-school activities.
I would love that.
And everything's just laid on for the wonder of all that, and then you have to become a grown-up and work out and do that stuff yourself. And so, once I got to university, I did kind of let loose a bit more. Though I was never into taking drugs and all that sort of stuff, which they do a bit in the film.
Can we start a comedian school? I'd love that.
I did think it would have been good. And I think, the good thing about the lockdown has been the days that I'd take a day where I'm working and then I'd do a day where I look after the kids and vice versa with my wife. Mm-hmm. And the day when you're working, you get to, we have an hour in the middle where we take over from the other one just to give them a rest because it's quite a long day. Yeah. And you get basically an hour at lunchtime to go and play with the kids. And you go, this is fucking awesome. Is they actually, it's weird, that middle hour is the best hour of the day, whichever one it is. It's like you get, you go from working to playing with the kids, it's brilliant. You go from playing with the kids to being on your own, and that's brilliant. And so that hour between 12:30 and 1:30 is now my favorite part of the day.
You love but going,
I went outside in the sunshine and played with my kids in the garden, and thought, you know, we should have that. This should be instituted to every working day. Everyone should go outside. There was a Viz character called Playtime Fontaine, I think it was called something like that,
right,
who was a bank manager, and they'd go out, the bell would ring, and they'd all go, all the bank managers would go and play in the, you know, and so on. You can fill in the blanks. But I think it's actually would be quite a nice thing to institute. Out of all the coronavirus things, I think that might be the thing that should stick, is that we should have a playtime for an hour a day. For lunchtime. So I think that's where I just identify, not particularly with either of them, particularly of the individually, I think just the whole feeling. There's a photo of me when I had a gap year between school and university, and there's a photo of I was going off to Camp America, and my mum and dad took me to Bristol Airport to fly to America. And there's just a photo of me and my mum, like, looking over the parapet onto the, you know, to the airfield. And I'm looking scared and my mum's looking worried, and it sort of just complete in a photo just completely sums up, you know, I'm sort of looking, we're both looking to the future and you know, I think again, then having kids, you're sort of also imagining that time for, you know, so the time you've got to let go of them and they've got to go off. And it sort of terrifies me because I think about, you know, I had a year off and went hitchhiking when I was 18 and I knew nothing and got into cars with some very strange people. And, you know, the idea of sending that child out and how my parents allowed me to do it, I don't know. But you sort of just got to let go, I suppose. You go, well, off you go. Fingers crossed. But just, you know, it's sort of terrifying. And it's that, I suppose that film really highlights that, is that moment between, or that time between childhood and adulthood where you're still ridiculously naive, but think you're an adult and think, but you're still, it's the terror as well, the terror of what's to come and not knowing what's to come. So I think it just beautifully summed that up. So it really kind of connected with me, that film, out of all the films I've seen recently. And I have seen, we don't watch a lot of highbrow stuff now. And Booksmart's probably about as highbrow as we get. It's highbrow. It's a really good film. And but also I like to be entertained. And I like to have fun now. And I don't, you know, in my 20s, I would go and watch more experimental stuff that I couldn't be asked to start watching now. But, and also your ability to concentrate is, both by age and having young kids, is out the fucking window anyway. So it was great to see, a non-superhero, non-kind of bawdy comedy, broad comedy that was genuinely funny and inventive. I think the only bit I didn't really like was when they become claymation or something, didn't they? Didn't really like that bit. But apart from that, the rest of it was top-notch. And it's Olivia Wilde, isn't it, who is one of the sexiest women in the absolute world, just beautiful and super intelligent, which is awesome.
Yeah, she's pretty fucking amazing.
Yeah.
You like a regimented life like school. Have you ever thought of an office job? You'd fucking love it. There's set hours, lunch breaks, desks.
I would like to do what I do, but be regimented. I'd just like to, was it School for Clowns or something like that? Something, I had a name for it at the time. I did write a blog about it and did sort of think it'd be great, you know, just to buy a building, wouldn't it? And just to have somewhere to go and write, though, you know, even if you all just had your own office in there.
Yeah, and hang out. It would be really
just
nice.
Because I think, like, probably around the time of Love Actually, where I was weeping watching Love Actually, you know, that I was just lonely. You know, I was finding it very difficult to, I think through a lot of my 20s and 30s, I was really lonely. I would find it struggle to ring people up and say, do you want to go and do stuff, and worry that I'd be imposing on them if I did. So just the idea where you can be with a group of people and feel confident that they sort of want to be with you, which you'd get at school. You know, who you can hang around with and who you can't, and at university as well. I think it's that difficulty. That's probably why I've chosen Booksmart, isn't it? Because of that.
That's really nice. All right, here we are. I think this is the part everyone's been waiting for. Richard Herring, what is the sexiest film you've ever seen?
Well, I think just in terms of it being the first sexy film I saw, and it being quite, I saw a film called The Other Cinderella.
Go on.
which is a soft porn film. It was a double bill back in the... I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
Me and my 14-year-old friends. This was an X film. It was a double bill with Kentucky Fried Movie, which is the precursor to Airplane. And actually, yeah, it's a pretty good film. There's some good bits that are better than others in it, but it's a bawdy sketch movie. I think we really went to see The Other Cinderella, which was a soft porn version of the Cinderella story. And the reason I'm telling you is it's a good story, but also I think it was me and four or five of my mates from school. We were all 14 and we all looked 14. The oldest one of some might have been 15, but he looked the youngest. And we actually went into the cinema in the order we thought we would get in, right? So it wasn't like, let's put the youngest looking one in first. So I think I was first. They decided I would have the best chance of getting in.
Right.
So I got in. So once I got in, everyone was quite happy. And then the only person that was questioned was my friend Phil Fry, who was the oldest by, you know, nearly a year over some of us. But then we all just went, yeah, no, he is. He's 18. And so they obviously didn't give a fuck. And they're like, it's the Wells Odeon. It's not there anymore. But this is like...
Because they were shut down because of this incident.
They might have been of this, but it was, I'm sure... I mean, we'll talk about Life of Brian in a second, but I'm sure it's like the Life of Brian sketch where everyone in that cinema was 14 pretending to be 18. Or just disgusting old men who were probably... And so it was the first... And there were no videos at this point. We did later start to see stuff like this on video and in a bit of a more private... But I just remember watching this... miraculous film where it was very tame women kissing each other, and you know, and it was a comedy as well, so it was
tame
like there was a bit where the guy made the two sisters kiss each other, or he was going to take their father away or something, and he was peeling an apple at the same time, and then he cut off his thumb because it got so exciting seeing them, these two women kissing, you know. So it wasn't really sexy.
Right.
But it was very sexy because we were 14 and we'd never seen anything like it. And basically we just all sat there with huge erections or tiny erections. But my favourite bit of it was there was just a woman took her top off and just a voice, and this is Wells in Somerset, a voice from the darkness shouted out, "Pert nipples!" And so I can still say that to my friends and we can still... We know exactly where we were, and whether that was another 14-year-old or whether, but we would say pert nipples to each other for a long time. So I think again, it's one of those watershed moments, isn't it? Where we were boys, we went in boys, we came out men, and one of our parents came and picked us up. So we must have had some lie in force. I think
yeah,
for that. I'm pretty sure. I don't think it was a matinee.
Maybe you said it was Cinderella. We went to see Cinderella.
I think we might have been clever enough to say we weren't going to the cinema. We'll talk about, but the same thing happened with Life of Brian, which we'll talk about later. But that's the my parents didn't want me to go and see Life of Brian, and we had to sneak our way out to see Life of Brian. But someone came and picked us up after seeing Life of Brian in the Wells Odeon. So
what exactly did you say?
I can't remember how we liked. You know, I just wonder whether, you know, as a parent, you realise you say a lot of stuff that you're meant to say, and you let some things go. And I wonder whether my parents, they've all sort of say now they had no idea we were watching. You know, 18 X films on video and stuff like that. But I just wonder if you go, oh, they're out of the house, thank God, you know, it doesn't matter what they're doing. They're in a cinema, it's safe. It doesn't matter.
Do what you like.
So, because my parents were strict, they would absolutely, at 14, they would have been horrified, I think, to think I was, you know, and it was very tame. And we did watch it on video a few years later and it seemed pathetic. But at the time, I think I might have even tried to find like a download of it on TV, on the internet, just to see. I don't think I managed to do that though, but just to see what it was like. But my friend Paul Putner bought me, having discussed this, he wasn't there because I didn't meet him for many years later. Oh no, I haven't got it. It's around here somewhere, but I've got the poster of Kentucky Fried Movie and The Other Cinderella.
Oh no.
It was that. It was one of those moments. It was a book smart moment.
I believe it happened. Richard Herring.
Yeah.
There's a subcategory to this question.
Yeah.
Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. What film did you find arousing that you thought perhaps you shouldn't?
Well, I mean, I think this is inappropriate for a lot of reasons, mainly because I was about 4 years old when I saw this film.
Okay.
And it's a very troubling film. Do you know the Louis Buñuel film Un Chien Andalous? It came up a couple, like, it was, when I was like and maybe it was at school, so I might have been 5 or 6, but it came up a couple of times on something like Open University. And you know, when you're off 6 from school, right, yeah, and Open University was on all day, and they'd show all sorts of stuff, and they showed clips from this film, and they showed the clip of the guy, and I have watched it since, but it's, you know, it's a very, it's a, you know, it's literally surreal. Yeah. It's a scary man chasing a woman around a house, and my memory of it, which is slightly out of whack, I think, is he, I can't remember what order it happens in actually now, but he's basically got ants running all over his hands. He's got a hole, I think, in his hand where the ants are coming out, and he's chasing this pretty woman around, and then he corners her, and he starts fondling her breasts through her clothing,
yeah,
and then in this, we see his imagination, or we the clothing disappears, and he's fondling her breast with his ant whole hands. and you see her breast, and you see it being fondled. And so I saw this as a, you know, as certainly a very minor, as of about 5, 6, 7 years old. And I saw it a couple of times, so it came back to me, and you know, and it was the sexiest thing I'd ever seen, because I was a child and never seen
an ant.
I'd never seen an ant before. So I knew it was very, I was very excited by the idea. But I think the associations that might have created in my mind, A, of a man behaving inappropriately, that's not good enough, even if he isn't covered in ants. Shouldn't be chasing women around fondling their bosoms. But, you know, I'd seen a bosom and I was very excited about that. And I did do a routine about this in one of my shows, saying, you know, it's had no effect on me. I mean, you know, I do get an immediately come in my pants if I see an ant or a woman covered in ants, or if anyone talks about ants in their pants. But there was a joke about it. But also, you know, it was this, it's a very inappropriate thing for a child to see. But I was very interested in sex from a very early age, and kind of, you know, had little mini crushes on people, and was, you know, knew that something was going on but didn't know what it was. So to see something like that and then think, imagine that is what sex is in any way about is not very helpful, is it?
How old were you when you were interested in sex from a very young age?
I think I was from right from the beginning. I remember I saw an Open University program when I was like maybe 4, which was all about sperm, you know, going into the, you know, under a microscope, sperm going into the egg, and me telling my mum all about how babies were made, and saying, you know, these tadpoles come in and they go. So I'd seen this program that I shouldn't have seen. I feel like my parents, they're not coming out of this very well. I think they were quite strict, but for some reason I got unfettered access to X-rated television at home. So I kind of was fascinated by it without knowing what it was, you know. And I think that's part of why, as a comedian, you know, I was interested in, as my kids are now, and all kids are, I presume, but I was doubly fascinated by all poo and wee and all the things that you weren't allowed to talk about, and why certain things were rude and why other things weren't rude. And like my daughter, I loved repeat poo poo wee wee bottom, whereas she's very much into saying, you know, I'll poo on your face and stuff like that. It's the stuff she's taken a whole nother level.
She's made it more sophisticated.
Yeah, she's absolutely very, you know, she takes it, I'll fart in your face, I'll poo. She's all over the place. But you know, I think it's that knowing that there's a barrier there that you're not allowed to, you're not supposed to know what's beyond the other side, but you're obviously absolutely, it just makes what's on the other side all the more fascinating. And, you know, I was always, I mean, just interested in it. I think interested in what that was about, and you know, and I knew that I was interested. You know, seeing that film, I knew that I shouldn't be seeing it, but I was also, you know, there's no reason why a 5-year-old should particularly be excited about seeing a woman's breasts, really. But I knew that what I was seeing was something titillating in every sense, and wrong, and exciting. And so, you know, it really stuck with me. It's like I'd had a little glimpse into this adult world, and then you think it's actually much, I mean, not now if you're with the internet, but for the 1970s, you couldn't really have seen anything much more weird and inappropriate than that. If you end up thinking that's anything to do with what sex is really about, then that's not good, is it?
That's fascinating.
To see it twice. And there's all the eyeball being cut open in that film. I think that was in the thing as well. So it's a very graphic, very sexy film. Very sexy, but inappropriate to find it sexy as a 5-year-old, I would say.
For sure.
So I think that's my worst one.
I think that fully qualifies. Richard Herring, objectively,
yeah.
What is the greatest film of all time?
I think it's difficult, and it's going to be a comedy because I love comedies. Mm-hmm. There's a toss-up, but I think it is This is Spinal Tap.
Correct.
And I'm sure lots of people have said this, but it's just an absolutely perfect piece of comedy, just and really watchable to the 100th degree. So you can watch this film throughout your life and see stuff somehow that you haven't seen before. I mean, I must have watched it 20 times at least, probably more than that. And we used to watch it when we were on tour, and it's very accurate about what being on tour is like. And it's just, and for an American film, I think as well, it's just all the English accents are phenomenal. All this, again, it's almost perfect. And you can pick up a couple of bits and go, oh, I think like when he gets trapped in the pod, it's too comic for the film. I think there's the little bits like that maybe Stonehenge is a bit too comic, but it's all really good. And it's all those little inflections. And you realise, I mean, I sometimes watch early Fist of Fun and you'll see a sketch and go, oh, God, that's just the entire inflections of this goes up to 11. Just with different words in it, it was so influential. And I think not without a lot of people realizing, and I think it probably, I don't think the stuff we did with Armando Day to Day and On the Hour and stuff was very much of the same ilk. And I don't think Armando had even seen it, but I think it, at the time, but I think it sort of pervades through in the sense that that was all improvised stuff around some ideas. And they're so on top of the game. But also, you listen to the music in that film and it fucking stands up. You just think, if I'd written that song, I think I tweeted Michael McKean. I think I must have tweeted at him in. And I think, might have just been Big Bottom. I was just saying, this is just such a brilliant comedy song. And then he responded, oh, thanks very much. He came back to me about it. But you just listen, the lyrics are great, but musically, they really were. They're great musicians.
Proper songs.
Yeah. And so it's, it's just this perfect film. And I think the first time I saw it, I'm not that into music. And I think even the first time I saw it, I wasn't entirely understanding if it was real or pretend. And so it's one of those films I think I didn't really like the first time I saw it. But that's nearly true of every comedy I like, that the first glimpse of it, you go, I've no idea what this is. This is weird. I don't like it. And then you get into it and it's so much to get into. And there's you can get the bonus extras with all the, they overshot so much.
Yeah.
And it's so good. It's all so good. I've had Harry Shearer on Rehelstapa.
Yes.
And he's incredible. And I like all the other ones they did, but I don't think any of them get anywhere near being as good as that is.
I think that is correct. And thank you for not saying The Godfather. What is the film that you can or have watched the most over and over again?
I've watched Die Hard pretty regularly, and I always still like it. So Groundhog Day is close, but it's starting to slightly pull for me, Groundhog Day.
Really?
Just slightly. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant film, but I'm not enjoying it as much, whereas Die Hard, I enjoy it exactly the same amount, if not more, every single time.
That's so nice for Die Hard.
And you still catch new things. I can't remember quite what there was. It's something in the scene where Alan Rickman and Bruce Willis are together, and he says his name's William such and such, and he's checking. There was a little bit in there. What was it? There was something. I can't even remember what it was, but there was something I noticed in that scene that I'd never noticed before. There was some lovely little bits of things in there. There's some great. It's good acting. Bruce Willis is fucking sharp in it. There's really good lines in it. Really funny. And it's properly good action film, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can watch that endlessly. Great Escapers, I can also watch endlessly. But Die Hard's the best.
Okay, Richard Herring, what is the worst film you've ever seen?
Very hard to choose. I watch a lot of Adam Sandler films that I loathe, but almost like as a result of... I go on about The Cobbler a lot in my podcast. I was very tempted to choose The Cobbler. Jack and Jill is probably the worst Adam Sandler film. And there's a lot to choose from. I think my worst ever film is Sliding Doors, which will take us back to alternate universes.
Talk to me, Richard.
I mean, this is the film that I wanted to do the director's commentary about, because I think there's so much to say about Sliding Doors that is awful. It completely misunderstands what would happen in the situation, which is my main problem with it. So, the minute you change anything, everything changes. but it does that thing that lots of alternate universe things do, of basically everything else moving as it would have done. Even though in the train, in one or when it's right at the beginning on the train, one time she meets John, or Jan Hannah's on the train, yeah. And one time he isn't. And the time he isn't, that she is on the train, he still turns up at the bar at the same time as he did in the other version. His life has definitely changed. She's been on the train. His life is completely different. So it just, even if it's 2 minutes later he turns up or something, would everything knocks on. It shouldn't be called Sliding Doors, first of all. It should be called Avoiding a Girl with a Doll. Because that is the moment that changes everything.
Yeah.
I think the girl drops the doll in one version and doesn't in the other. Or it's a little girl gets in Gwyneth Paltrow's way in one version and doesn't in the other version.
Yeah.
And that's the moment. It isn't the Doors, it's the doll. So it's badly
titled. But what? So hang on. What do you want to call it? Avoiding a doll, a drop doll.
Yeah. Well, I'd have to go back and double check what it is exactly. But I think basically,
I wonder if that would have taken off as a catchphrase. People say, you know, oh, you had your avoiding a drop doll moment.
Yeah. It would have done in that the universe where it had been correctly named. It might have done. I mean, there's so much. There's so much in it that I just loathe. I talked to Michael Palin about this because I asked, there's a Spanish Inquisition sketch in it and he didn't get paid for it, even though he wrote the Spanish Inquisition sketch. But there's no reality in any, even if the universe is infinite and every reality exists, there is no reality in which a man can quote a Monty Python sketch quite badly and get to fuck Gwyneth Paltrow. That will never happen, even in a universe of infinite possibilities. So, believe me, I know. Not necessarily with Gwyneth Paltrow, but I know. And it's just that, it's the thing where they're all going about Grolsch. They go, do you want a Grolsch? I don't know if they've been sponsored by Grolsch or whether they just think they're being cool for saying Grolsch, but it absolutely dates the film 100% precisely. The comedy in it's awful. The comedy make last everything is awful. And it annoys me that, in one reality she dies, right? And the other reality, but it basically all sort of sorts itself out or something. And then she goes, there's that bit of memory at the end when she goes, well, you know what the Monty Python boys say, or whatever it is. And she goes, and you go, no, don't do that. You weren't in that reality. Fuck off. You can't have a bit from the other reality. That kind of seeped across into your consciousness. My daughter was born and my son was born in the hospital where the sliding doors lifts are.
Where they drop,
Westminster, Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. Lifts, that's where he gets in at the end. It's just a terrible, terrible film. And I think there's a lot of terrible films that are bad and don't do very well. And this is the film that is the worst that has done the best, I would say. And is considered by many people still to be good and still gets shown on TV. I think the comedy is bad. The understanding of the premise of alternate universes is terrible. And, you know, it's this idea that, oh, magically those two would have got together. No. Like you say, if one thing changed in that cinema, if we'd been to see a different film, would me and my wife be together? Yeah. Maybe not. Yeah, you know, it could be a seeing Dan in real life moment. That's what it could be.
Yeah.
It's a real seeing Dan in real life, isn't it? Versus
the
good film that was on that year.
I think it's the best, the worst execution of the best premise film.
Maybe, but you see, I'm very critical. I don't like The Truman Show because I think they make so many errors with what is that, the premise that everyone has thought about and you'd like to do, to the extent that The Truman Show, that I think is close to Sliding Doors in that was more successful than Sliding Doors. And I think the execution of it is bad. In like, there's that bit in The Truman Show where he's going, hey, stop, watch this. And look, the same people are going by behind us all the time. It's not a fucking cartoon. Like, if he started noticing that, the producers go, oh, guys, in fact, I don't know why we told you to go on a loop. Don't go on a loop. Just live your life like you're living your life. Someone would tell those actors to stop going in a loop. But why are they fucking going in a loop? That's not how it would work, is it? Everyone would just carry on living their lives. And so, you know, I think it's poorly conceived, that one. But, it's a better film, but probably overall than Sliding Doors. So Sliding Doors is the worst film.
What film? You're in comedy, Richard. You're very successful at it. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
Well, this is another contender for the best film of all time, but I think the film that has consistently made me laugh the most, Spinal Tap would obviously be up there as well, is Life of Brian.
We're finally at Life of Brian.
Yes.
We've teased
which
it a
I
lot.
Think is, I mean, it's just, but again, it's such an important film for me in that I wasn't allowed to see it. I got, with Monty Python, I missed all the TV version of it. And so the films are really important. I've got like our albums. I listened to, LPs. Mm. And I'd got the Monty Python, The Life of Brian LP. So I kind of was aware, and the book, and I'd got all that sort of stuff. But my mum and dad wouldn't let me go and see it because it was an AA or whatever it was at the time. So you had to be over 14 or 15. And I was probably 13 or 14. So I was close. But because of that, they wouldn't let me go. My parents were religious, obviously, so I think it was slightly to do with that as well. So, A, we had to go and sneak our way in to see it, which made it a very important film in my life. But I think it's them at their absolute height. And when I had Pipe Palin on, I kind of realised that when you look at him in that film, you almost forget it's the same guy. The characterisation is so good that you go, oh, fuck, the ex-leper's the same guy as the prisoner guy, same with the nicest, wettest as the guy, you know, at his crucifixion, one cross on the left. All these different characters he's playing in it, and you sort of buy into the reality so much. You obviously know it's him, but you forget it's him. So he is phenomenal, but they're all absolutely at the top of the game. Chapman sort of is sober and really firing on all cylinders. John Cleese, thank God, didn't play Brian, which he wanted to do, I think, originally. But he's so good in all those characters. And, yeah, I mean, just every single one of those sketches is more than Holy Grail, where there's a few of those sketches that you take out as a sketch and go, that's a brilliant sketch. But it also works as a whole as well. So all these incidents come together. But it's so smart. And, you know, it comes from a time when you're allowed to be that clever in comedy and not someone going, oh, do you think people understand about conjugating Latin verbs? It doesn't matter if you understand any of that stuff. You know why that's fun. Those scenes are funny whether you know about it or not. And, I think it was so groundbreaking, and it's so important to me, I think, to see, a subject that I would have been scared about joking about. Because I was not religious anymore, but I was still, for a long time, that still hung over me, that feeling of, even when I did Christ on a Bike, I remember there was a part of me thinking, oh God, should I be doing this? What's the repercussions of this on my soul, really, if I'm wrong? It's just funny, start to finish funny all the way. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life is their best song in terms of just singability.
It's such a profound ending. I genuinely think it's like one of the great endings.
And I don't, Holy Grail's a bit of a cop-out ending, and I didn't really like Meaning of Life in the same to any. There's some good bits in Meaning of Life, but it doesn't kind of gel in the same way. So I think they just, and a lot of the TV show Monty Python isn't great. A lot of it is very experimental and it doesn't stand up. But Life of Brian, apart from I would guess that there would be some accusations of transphobia and stuff now about it. But apart from that, it kind of, and even that, I think you'd have to struggle a bit to really seriously think of it in that way. But it stands up, and there's a man with a lisp and a speech impediment, if you're worried about that sort of thing. But it's so artfully done, it's so brilliantly done.
Yeah, that was about to become a Monty Python sketch. And, of course, the other thing that we
But, yeah, exactly. And I hadn't even thought about that. So there's so many brilliant bits in it.
Richard Herring.
Yeah.
You've been excellent. I really appreciate all your time. Now, however, when you went to do a Twitch record of your stone clearing, and it was a few years in the future, you built up this wall of stones quite high. I mean, Trump was tweeting you like he was impressed with this wall you'd been building of stone clearings. Yeah. He was one of your Twitch followers, by the way. That's a little sub story you didn't know about. And you built this wall, your stone clearing. You're doing a special live stream Twitch to raise money for comedian school that you're trying to set up. And,
that'd be nice.
It got up to space. You'd planned it to get up to space, but it's gone further. And you stood there, and the connection's a bit faulty on your phone, trying to film it, and it collapsed onto you.
Yeah.
It wasn't caught on camera, and you were perfectly entombed in these stones. Immediately, as promised, I come round to take over the family, but also to bury you. But I come out there, you're already buried perfectly, and in your will it says, if I die under some stones and stone glue, don't move me, don't touch anything. And I go, oh, fine. Big old mess of stones, but so I'm looking at them, I'm like, what can I do? And really, there's only enough room in the clearing of stones that I could slip one DVD between the stones, for you to take to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. One night, it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone in heaven when it's your movie night, Richard Herring? Go.
I'm taking the extended version of Spinal Tap.
Ooh.
I'm taking with all the extra scenes.
What a lovely
You're
going
to have to slot in two DVDs. Or just use put it on a little thing and put it into a computer now. We don't have
to have a DVD. Yeah, we'll put it on one disc because the rules are the rules. Yeah. Richard Herring, you've been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anything you would like to tell people to listen out for or look out for if they aren't already?
Well, yeah, my podcast Rahelis Topo is out every week, and you can watch some of them live streamed on twitch.tv/RK Herring on Wednesdays during the lockdown, maybe beyond, who knows.
So that was episode 96. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat and the full uncut video with Richard. Go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating if you can, and write about the film that means the most to you and why. Listen, I hope everyone is well. I hope you're all doing good. And thank you for listening. Thank you for being involved. Thanks to Richard for doing the show. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics. Lisa Lydon for the artwork. Come join me next week, where I believe my excellent guest will be the amazing, the incredible, the phenomenal Sarah Millican. Uh-oh! So in the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, be excellent to each other.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.